Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Missing Frames. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. This is the podcast, in case you're wondering, where we watch movies we probably definitely should have seen by this point in our lives. Today, joining me is none other than Mr. John Mills. How are you, sir?
I'm being Mr. John Millsy. How are you, Sean?
I'm just jealous of you being John Millsy. If only I could reach that level.
I'm like boss level. Not like Joker on the original Batman game, but you know. Somewhere around.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah. You definitely, I've noticed that when you get weak or you're reaching the end of your stamina, you start blinking red. And
yes.
It becomes more frequent the weaker you get. So that comparison is completely accurate.
Yeah, they have yet to diagnose what causes it, but we're hoping for a cure either way.
There you go. So we're here to discuss none other than Blade Runner, which is now a classic. And it's classic enough to spawn a sequel. How many years after the fact? 30?
Everything 30 to 40 years old is either getting rebooted or a sequel. It's just the way.
Yeah, this isn't new, guys. You think you're so smart, Ridley Scott? Nah, I don't think so. But we figured, why not take a gander at Blade Runner? And I was trying to come up with an excuse because I've seen Blade Runner. You've seen Blade Runner. But what we realized was, I've never seen the theatrical cut of Blade Runner, and you have never seen the final cut of Blade Runner. So
that's true.
That's the excuse for this Missing Frames episode. And then we'll wrap it all up with a review of Blade Runner 2049. And by the time we air this episode, that will be out in theaters.
Yes. Yes, indeed it will. And I am excited because I've seen, how many cuts of Blade Runner are there? Five, right?
Too many. There are five. Yeah,
five.
Maybe
cuts?
I think there's an argument that there might be more out there.
Okay, because
five officially.
I know of three for sure. Because I know there are two that I'm missing them, because there's theatrical, there's director's cut that came out in the 90s, and then there is the final cut. What are the two that I'm missing?
There's a work print cut
that
which
does not count.
It's counted. It is on the Blu-ray as one of the five cuts. So it is. It apparently does count. I'm not sure what's different about that one. And then there's the international cut, I think.
International audiences
don't
count.
No, nah. They don't count. They're not real people. Nah. They're not real Americans like we are. But
you know what? If I have to count the international cut of Blade Runner, then I have to count the international cut of the Twin Peaks premiere from 25 years ago, and I'm not going to do that.
Right? No one would want to do that, because that doesn't that effectively end the show in the first episode?
Why? It sure does. Yes,
so
it does.
Why would anyone do that? But with apologies to Lee Hutchison, another one of our Nerd Party members, who is technically international. I guess we're all international to people who are not in our country. I mean, aren't we all international in some way?
You're blowing my mind, man. Can we just talk about replicants?
Let's talk about that. And on that note, we've wrapped Blade Runner. Speaking of Lee, he's on a great show called Filibuster. John, you want to go ahead and pimp out your shows? Because why not? Well, let's do it at the start of the show.
Oh, yeah.
While people are still listening and they still care about what we have to say.
Well, they're going to care about what we have to say at the end, too. I guarantee you that. But yes, I'm Kessel Junkie over online. Here on the network, you can find me on Great Shot Kid, which I co-host with Mike Schindler. You can find me on Aggressive Negotiations, which I co-host with Matthew Rushing. You can find me out in the wild co-hosting Words with Nerds with Craig Sorrell. And you can find me over on the Trek FM network, again with Mike Schindler, co-hosting Stage 9.
And you can find me in absolutely none of those places, which is, I guess, a ringing endorsement, depending on how much you enjoy the show. I got to get back on Words with Nerds. I miss you guys.
You do. We got to finish up our bond thing, man. Come on.
I know. We will do that. That'll happen, and it should happen before whatever Bond 24 or whatever number it is now comes out. So definitely, follow at Join Nerd Party on Twitter, like the Nerd Party on Facebook. Definitely give us a 5-star rating. We highly approve of 5-star ratings for obvious reasons, but feel free to subscribe to our show as well, and check out all the other shows too. They're great. They really are. So Blade Runner, John, did you see this in theaters? Were you like part of the crew understood the, like, you know, when it came out, nobody, I actually think the answer is nobody saw this in theaters because nobody liked it and no, it didn't make much money.
I'm not that old that I would have been allowed to see it in the movie theaters. You know, the R-rated sci-fi epic from Ridley Scott. My parents would have been like, no, 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 let's watch the Indiana Jones movies.
So lame. You know what's funny? I think the Indiana Jones movies are actually maybe more violent than Blade Runner.
Yes, but it's cartoonish
Temple
violence.
Temple of Doom, definitely.
Oh,
yeah, more or less.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah. Well, what I.
So when did you first see it?
I first saw it actually on home video on a relic of technology called a VHS cassette, because my dad rented it, and my dad could sometimes be a little loosey goosey with what I saw. I remember it being my dad for some reason. It's entirely possible that it was just.
So how old were you?
Oh gosh, I was less than 10.
I was going to say, you make it sound like it was like, oh, I probably should not have been watching this movie.
Yeah, but he also tripped up and showed me Blues Brothers when I was way too young. So,
hey,
you know,
there you go.
It explains a lot about me, doesn't it? But the for some reason, I remember my dad, and I remember not really getting it. Like, watching it and being like, what? I think, is that Han Solo? And being very confused by that.
Why is he so depressed and not fun?
Come on, Han, you're out of carbonite. But then there is, years later, I saw it on VHS again because one of my friends had it, and I kind of fell in love with it. I was like, wow, this is really cool, man. I really like this.
This is the theatrical version both times, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because the director's cut wasn't available till late 90s, I think.
Yes, when a scourge known as Laserdisc made such things available. And they release it in theaters, a limited release, I believe. And I remember people.
The director's cut?
Yeah, I think so. For some reason, I want to say there was a limited theatrical release.
I was reading that something happened where some Warner Brothers employee stumbled on a copy of Blade Runner without the voiceover. And they were just like, it's the director's cut. And they released it. And it was getting so much good traction that they got in touch with Ridley Scott, who was like, You can't call it a director's cut. I had nothing to do with what you're showing, but if you want to call me back, that's fine. But they didn't listen. They released it as the director's cut.
Well,
but I think you're right. It did have some sort of theatrical release.
Well, I remember the big hullabaloo about it was, of course, the ending was technically different because they took something away from the ending, and then they have the infamous unicorn dream, which, if I recall correctly, is just footage from another Ridley Scott production called Legend inserted there. And I know that started the whole, you know, he's a replicant debate. And I know that Ridley Scott has since said, well, yeah, he's a replicant. And it's even Harrison Ford. I read a recent interview with him where, you know, no, he's not a replicant. So, you know, who knows?
That is a spot on Harrison Ford impression.
Modern day. I can't do a young Harrison, but I can, you know.
It's like Bob Dylan. I can't really do young Bob Dylan is like, hey, but old Bob Dylan is so easy because he's like, hey, have you heard his Christmas album? It's terrifying. Merry Christmas,
be worse.
Ring the bells. Oh, it's terrible.
Can't be worse than Christopher Lee's heavy metal Silent Night.
Well, that I still need to check out. That's on my future Christmas list. But I think the big difference was that the director's cut made it almost more cerebral. By getting rid of the voiceover, you are no longer kind of having things explained to you. And then they added that unicorns thing where it's like, oh, is it a dream that he's having? Is he a replicant? But in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't make sense if he's a replicant. Like, it doesn't not make sense, but it's like it almost robs it a little bit of, I guess, what it's trying to say about humanity in a way. Like, if he's a replicant?
For me, it is. I will actually make reference to a mutual friend of ours, Joey, who, in terms of the narration, he talked about it because we were, he was taking a film class and they showed Blade Runner, the director's cut in it. And he, like, the professor was talking about how much better it was than the theatrical cut. And I remember Joey relaying the story to me at the time where the professor then mentioned something about Deckard's past. And apparently Joey was the one in the studio or the room or whatever who said, no, That's in the voiceover. That's not in this cut. And the professor had to cop to, oh, I guess I'm just remembering something from that. And, I'd be very interested for anybody who hasn't seen the film with narration. It's much more of a film noir than the director's cut is. The director's cut is just a dark, moody sci-fi, but the voiceover, I always thought, was supposed to just evoke the fact that it's a callback to like a 1950s detective noir movie.
Yeah, originally, I think when they originally wrote the screenplay, it did have voiceover in it, but apparently Harrison Ford said, like, why, I'm talking about doing all this detective work, but I'm not actually doing, I'm a detective who doesn't detect anything. So he said, let's take some of this voiceover and put it in scenes. So they actually ended up cutting the entire thing out. And then eventually, you know, when the film was getting closer to release and it had all kinds, it was plagued with production woes. It went over budget. It went over schedule. I think Ridley Scott got fired for a little bit. It was such a miserable shoot. And then they finally get a cut together and everyone's sitting there and, you know, the studio is like, this isn't really working. Now, apparently Ridley Scott was like, I agree. I see what you're saying and I want to help make this work. What can we do? And they were like, well, what about a voiceover? Get Harrison in to do a voiceover. And Harrison, this is legend that has been confirmed by Harrison Ford. He was so avidly against the voiceover. He thought it was stupid and clunky. He thought it was some of the worst dialogue. He was like, you can't actually expect me to read this. So he went into the studio and purposefully sabotaged it because he was like, first of all, this is terrible. Second, I'm going to make sure, just in case they actually decide to use this, that this is so bad that they would never decide to use it. But then they actually used it. So it's kind of amazing in that way. So when I saw Blade Runner, it was, I can't remember what exactly, I remember being interested in watching it. I asked a friend for it for Christmas when I was in high school, and he got it for me, but when I decided to sit down and watch it, I was also horribly sick. Like, this is one of the, I can't remember the last time I was this sick. I had, like, the flu or something. I was kind of delusional, and I was like, well, this is the perfect time to watch Blade Runner. And I don't know why the two things occurred to me. But I put it on, and I'm literally, I have no idea what's happening. I'm watching this movie. I can't understand who I am as a person because I'm so sick. I don't have any clue what's happening in the movie. I'm like, what? So I watched it, and it did not make sense to me at all. I was like, I don't get it. I don't think I liked that. I don't understand it. And this is like the director's cut was the only version available on DVD at the time. So that was the only version I had to watch. I couldn't even retreat to like the theatrical version for comfort and hope to have things explained to me with Harrison Ford droning on. But I think they started talking about releasing the final cut. And that had kind of re-sparked my interest because I was reading a little bit more about it, reading a little bit more about its influence, starting to realize how much of an influence it had on a lot of sci-fi movies I've seen. Because it's arguably one of the most influential sci-fi movies this side of like 2001 and Star Wars. You cannot watch a sci-fi movie in this day and age without seeing some element that Blade Runner kind of instilled, like the rain, the grime, the kind of lived in future, like the visual look of it is so unique. So I actually, right around the time the final cut came out, I bought it and I watched it again, and it finally kind of clicked with me. I was like, okay, it engages you visually and it doesn't necessarily engage you on a human level. But then the more I watched it, the more I appreciated it, and the more I engaged with it on every level. It was one of those movies I feel like you had to watch multiple times to get. But part of the reason I've never, ever gone back and watched the theatrical version is because I think, first of all, there's like this pretentious kind of film snobbish thing of like, oh, the theatrical version with the voiceover for morons. Like, you need a voice. Like, I think this is kind of like people treat you pretty, like you're an, like, you know, it's a film snob thing. You don't watch the theatrical cut. What are you, crazy? But I personally, the reason I never watched it was partly because I am a film snob, but partly because I'm so now used to the visual kind of tone poem that it is, that thinking of a voiceover almost ruins it for me. Like, it's such a, like, I connect to it on such a visual and auditory level. Like, it feels very hypnotizing to me. So, like, the idea of, like, a voiceover coming in kind of is like, I don't know how I feel about this. So that's kind of why I've avoided it.
Well, the thing that's always, you know, the thing that I always love to point out that is sort of like the thumb in the eye is that what Scott has done now, and I haven't seen the final cut yet, obviously, but like what Ridley Scott has done is, in my mind, not really different than what George Lucas did with Star Wars, where it's a director who was looking at something, and even though there were people who said, I love this, it's perfect, it's wonderful, don't change it, said, I'm not really happy with this. There are these things here that need to be changed. And Ridley Scott, for him, it was removing things, and then with the final cut, fixing things. And Lucas's impulse was, these are things that were always supposed to be in there, so I'm going to put them back in, and that is what I want it to be, and I'm going to clean up, you know, certain other things that have always bothered me. I think that Ridley Scott and George Lucas show the exact same impulse. I mean, even Coppola showed the same impulse with Apocalypse Now, where he goes back years later and completely re-edits the whole damn thing with Walter Murch and says, this is the movie that I really wanted to make, and this is the movie I didn't have time to make.
They do, and the only reason I still criticize George Lucas is, one, because it completely baffles me that we live in a world, and this is no discredit to Blade Runner, which I truly believe is one of the great films of all time, but it baffles me that we live in a world where we have 5 cuts of Blade Runner, and I think a couple of them have minuscule differences, but they're all readily available. They're all on Blu-ray. They all come in the set that you get, whereas Star Wars, you only get the special edition. And I personally believe, with Blade Runner at least, the changes that are made don't necessarily distract. Like, they're kind of, they clean up things, they improve. It's like kind of things like wires on cars, they clean those up a little bit, things like that. Whereas with Star Wars, it's very clearly a jump in technology that almost distracts the eye in a way. You know, again, with Coppola, it's the same thing with Apocalypse Now. You have 2 cuts that are available for you to watch. It's baffling. Maybe let's just go watch every cut of Blade Runner ever, and then we can finally just shoot ourselves.
There's no way that I'm going to watch a work print, because work prints are work print. I mean, it's not that.
That seems desperate. It's right. Like, what? Wait, there's a bonus 5th cut, and it's like a workman. Like, what?
I think that is really for the cinephile, because, you know, work prints are not. You know, they're called work prints for a reason. They're not ready for public consumption. They're purposely, like, you should only watch a work print if you are just maddeningly devoted to the idea of process and understanding the process. Like, I would love to see, there's a work print of Star Wars out there that somebody actually saw and wrote about. I would love to see that, just because I am fascinated by the process. But it doesn't count as a cut of the film.
No, I think it is a cool thing to have, but I agree with you. I don't know if it should be counted in like the, there are 6 cuts on this Blu-ray and that's one of them. I don't think I'll ever watch it, except for like, if I wanted to see how the process worked. But it is funny how that works, though, like with all these special editions. And then now, I mean, Blade Runner 2049 is very much a kind of Force Awakens revival coming out of nowhere. I shouldn't say coming out of nowhere. It's been a long time coming. But I'm excited about Blade Runner 2049. I remember when they announced it, and I was kind of skeptical. I was like, why would you jump on the sequel bandwagon? But then they announced who was attached to direct it. They announced that Roger Deakins was shooting it. And I was kind of like, all right. I'm okay with this. This sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I was skeptical about it, and then I actually saw a movie by Denis Villeneuve, or Villeneuve, however you pronounce his last name. Okay, whatever.
That's not how you pronounce his name. Okay. I'm just being an ass.
I'm going to call him DV.
DV, okay.
But when I finally saw a film by him is the moment where I said, I'm really excited for Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah, because at that point when they announced him, I think I'd seen Prisoners and I'd just seen Sicario. So it was like, okay. So this guy knows what he's doing and is a very, very strong choice as far as like If you wanted to win me over, a skeptic, that's how you do it. And then when Arrival came out, it was just even more confirmation. It was like, oh, great, so he can do science fiction too. Awesome. So this movie's going to be fantastic. And judging from the reviews so far, it is fantastic. Even more reason to be excited about
it. Indeed. But I'm actually equally excited to finally see the final cut of Blade Runner. I'm really excited to see it.
I'm honestly really excited to watch the theatrical version. I kind of wish I might go and watch the final cut before I see 2049, but I've seen that enough that I don't have to. I'm excited to watch the theatrical version just because I've never seen it. I know Guillermo del Toro is a huge proponent of it. He's always talked about how much he loves it. It's cool. It's nice to finally sit down and watch it. It'll be interesting to see how I react to it and how you react to that. And before we get going, I just want to have, as we're about to go and sit down and screen this movie for ourselves, I want to talk about a very special screening of this movie that I prompted at my university, my college.
Uh-oh.
So I was going to a conservative Christian school, and one of my film classes, we every week would watch a movie. They would screen it in one of our screening rooms. And the movie on schedule was Braveheart, but during class, I'd brought up that Blade Runner, the final cut, had just come out. And I was talking with the teacher about it, and the professor was like, oh my God, Blade Runner, it's a masterpiece, and it's da-da-da. And I was telling him how cool the final cut was. And we were so excited about it that we finally convinced the rest of the class. It was like, well, how about this? What if we replaced Braveheart with Blade Runner? Would you guys want to do that? And they were all like, yeah, let's do it. And I kid you not, we went and watched this movie, and I've never seen so many people so depressed and so confused. Like, the lights came up, and it was kind of like, let's talk about this movie. And everyone was like, I don't know how to feel. I don't know what and I was like, no, I've been there. Trust me. I had the flu and I watched it. I get it. But like, that's one of my proudest moments, is just unleashing Blade Runner on an unsuspecting film community.
I love
especially
that.
Like with very like, conservative kind of, like, it's like Braveheart is kind of like, it's violent, but it's like very like, yeah, it's Braveheart. So I unleashed this very dark, disturbing science fiction film on this unsuspecting Christian college, and I'm still so proud of it to this day. That's one of my defining moments.
What I will say is that, number one, I love that story. That's fantastic. But number two, I will say that I, in later years, became a fan of the works of Philip K. Dick, who, that, you know, this film is based on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And I can tell you, hands down, this is one of those things where I could tell you everything about the movie. Go ahead and read the book. It's not going to spoil anything except a character name. That's it, folks. That is all. Even the world is completely different. Like, it is. And the thing, just in case anybody's unfamiliar with Philip Dick's work, he was a heroin addict. And so all of his stories really have to do with questions of reality and identity. And there are parts of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, not as bad as A Scanner Darkly, but where you read it and you end the chapter and you stop and you're like, what? Wait, what? Okay, what? Okay. Oh, that. This guy, it's really interesting. I do encourage people to read the book, because it's the seventh cut of Blade Runner. So there you go.
Perfect. I do have it, and I do want to read it. I don't know if I'll be able to read it in time for us to return and review everything, including Blade Runner 2049, but it's okay. Someday it will happen. But all right, well, let's break. We'll go watch these movies. We'll go see Blade Runner 2049, and then we will reunite on the other side to discuss.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. Welcome back, everybody. We watched our respective cuts of Blade Runner, and we also watched Blade Runner 2049. So this is going to be a pretty intense conversation, wouldn't you say, John?
Is. It's going to be extremely, extremely intense. Everything's a lot redder than I remember it, but I'm feeling comfortable.
I think, you seem very comfortable. You seem happy. I hope I can ruin that for you in the next 45 minutes or however long this takes. John, what did you think of the final cut?
Okay, Final Cut, I think, redresses a lot of the issues I had with the quote-unquote director's cut, where everything was still timed for narration. I thought this was a tighter edit. I thought that it was cleaner. I thought the film looked beautiful, and I enjoyed it and can say hands down that as much as I have a nostalgic twinge for the narration still, since it's the first version I ever watched, this is my preferred cut of the film. I'm dying to know, for somebody who's never seen the narrated version, please tell me what your reaction was.
All right. Well, first of all, I think that's great. It's funny. A lot of people who saw the theatrical version first seem to be like, but I like the voiceover. So I'm actually pleasantly surprised you enjoyed the final cut as much as you did. The theatrical version, you know, I was honestly expecting it to be more different than it was. I knew the ending was happier. I knew there was voiceover narration, but it's pretty much the same movie otherwise. Not a whole lot changed about it. The final cut's a little bit more violent. I remember, like, you know, the theatrical version doesn't have Roy bursting Tyrell's eyes, or it doesn't show you the after effect of him pushing the nail through his hand. You just see it happens off screen. Yes. So I remember the final cut being like, oh, it's a little bit more violent, but, you know, I love violence, so great. The theatrical version was exactly kind of what I expected, which what I was saying in the pre-show was I was introduced to Blade Runner, and I appreciate Blade Runner as a very visual tone poem. It feels very hypnotic, and it kind of pulls you into its world, and you're on its wavelength. And to have that interrupted by Harrison Ford's, well, sushi, that's what my ex-wife used to call me. And it was like, oh my God, no. I lost it. The first time he started speaking, I was like, oh my God. The voiceover is pretty clunky. And what was most shocking to me about the voiceover, or not shocking, but it doesn't clarify anything really. Like, the whole point of the voiceover was an attempt to help the movie make sense to general audiences, because they were like, oh, it's not working, people don't know what it's about. But for the most part, the narration is basically Harrison Ford describing the obvious. Like, he basically is like, and here I am walking into the room. So it felt very strange to me, because I was trying to picture it as like, okay, if I saw this, I still wouldn't understand it, even with the narration.
Well, I think that the narration functions so long as you approach it as, this is a film noir detective story. You know, that dame walked into my office one day, and I looked her in the eye, and I thought, wow, you got some gams, kid. You know, it works like that, and there is some minor world-building stuff, because it mentions his ex-wife, and it mentions the language that Edward James Olmos is speaking is a polyglot of Japanese and Spanish and English all mashed together, because that's what, you know, it's one giant monoculture. But having watched the final cut, what it really sunk into me with was, it's obvious he understands what he's saying, that he's playing, you know, a gambit to make it look like he doesn't understand, and it doesn't matter what language he's talking.
Yeah,
I don't understand it.
That's the thing.
All that matters.
It was a lot of, that's kind of what I mean. A lot of the stuff that he was stating was like, okay, one, I didn't need to know that. Like, it's like, do I need to know he has an ex-wife? It doesn't really. I get what you're saying about the noir, and I really tried to watch it in that respect. I tried to be like, okay, this is kind of, maybe I can appreciate this more if I look at it as an homage to those old films and that kind of like hard-boiled, like, detective going into the room and narrating, because I can jump on board with that. But it was just the fact that Blade Runner's style, even though it is evoking that, just the type of movie it is, it clashes, because it's such a visual movie. It has so much emphasis on the visuals and the sound, that when you bring that in, it totally threw me off. And especially at the end, I think, you know, Frank Darabont specifically references this point as like the moment where he's like, are you kidding me, with the voiceover. But at the end, when he dies, and, you know, gives his tears in the rain speech, and then it's like, it's this beautiful moment, and then Harrison Ford comes in, I don't know why he chose to save my life. Maybe in those final moments he appreciated life more than he ever had before. And it was like, oh, no.
Yeah,
no.
I think that people's reaction to the narration would be markedly less antagonistic. I don't know. That's probably, I mean, that's the wrong word, but however.
No, people are pretty antagonistic about it.
I know, negative feeling they have, I think if he hadn't had that moment, I was like, well, that thing you thought he might have meant when he said tears in the rain, that's what he meant.
Yeah, that you was, know? I think that was the biggest insult where it was like, ugh. But by that point, you know, it was interesting because the narration isn't consistent throughout the movie. By that, I mean, it pops up at the most random spots. Like, it was very hard for me, like, because I would get invested in the movie and then it would come in and it just felt so out of place. And part of that, I think, is because the first version I saw of the movie was the director's cut, was the version without narration. I don't mean to be snobby about it, but it's like it does work better without it. But, it was very hard for me to separate. It's like somebody covering a song that you absolutely love and, you know, the instruments come in and you recognize it and you're like, oh, yes. And then they start singing and it's like, oh, no. Oh, God, I'm going to put on the original version. It's like it just something about it felt off to me. So whenever it came in, it reminded me like, oh, I'm not watching the version I like. I'm watching this weird alternate awkward version. And another instant that really bothered me was when he shoots in the back, and he walks up to her, and in the movie it's such a beautiful moment because he's very clearly kind of stunned and disturbed by what just happened. And then in the theatrical version, it's this beautiful image of her on the glass and the reflection of the lights, and it just looks gorgeous, and the music it just works so well. And at that moment, I wasn't expecting narration. I was kind of prepping myself at like, okay, it'll probably come in at this point. But when it came in there, I was like, oh, come on. Like, he's basically like, I was reminded in that moment of Rachel. And I was like, oh, God. But it was very, I really tried to watch it like, kind of like you were saying, like, oh, look at it as like an homage to noir films. But it just didn't work for me because Blade Runner, as much as it owes to that style, is so stylistic and visual and all about those visuals and the audio and the sound. You know, it felt like it was hitting a false note every single time it happened. It was just like, ugh, it grated on me.
Yeah. No, I can definitely see that. The thing that jumps out at me, and it's maybe an odd comparison, but there was an alternate ending to Terminator 2 where it actually showed Sarah Connor in the future talking to
her tape recorder,
like, oh, Kyle Reese didn't get born, I guess, this time, and everything's okay. And I think that the strongest argument for the final cut or director's cut, either way, is the ending, because the ending of that is open. It is, they walk into the elevator, and you have that beautiful line, you know, you don't know how long she has, but then again, who does?
Yeah.
And that's the right note to end on. And, you know, it's just like the right note for Terminator 2 to end on is the shot of that road going by and saying the future's open now. We don't know what's going to happen. That's what is supposed to happen.
Yeah, that was, and again, that ending, it felt as tacked on to me as the voiceover. It felt very like, oh, God, no, what, no. Like, they're driving off into the mountains and everything's wonderful and life isn't so bad. And I was like, this is just totally in contrast to everything I've seen.
The thing I had always heard, but I've never seen any direct confirmation, but the rumor that I've always heard is that is actually a shot from The Shining.
It is. It is 100% true.
So it is, in fact, 100%. Wow.
Yep. So they basically, because Warner Brothers had the rights, and Stanley Kubrick, they called them up, and he was a big fan of Ridley Scott. So he was like, absolutely, I'm happy to help, but you can't use any of the actual footage that was in The Shining. You can use all the B-roll. We had like hours and hours of B-roll that we shot that you are welcome to use, but don't use any of my footage.
I can only imagine that, like, the editorial assistant that had to catalog and look through it, like, just had his picture up on the wall, was just throwing darts at it the whole, screw you.
Well, I mean, if you have hours, I mean, come on, the Shining, you have like maybe a minute total of like mountainous footage of the helicopter shot. So you probably, if you have hours and hours, you could probably pick out of a shot without that wasn't in the movie.
No, please. Like Kubrick, what was his shooting to cut ratio? It was like, you know, 4,000 feet of film to every second or something. Not an actual statistic, folks, just exaggerating. But yeah. No, there yeah. So that's, I'm glad you still, you know, dug the, I'm actually probably going to go back and watch the version with the narration just for old time's sake.
Yeah, I would love to like pick up the final. I'm going to probably go back and watch the final cut just because I'm on such a high right now after seeing this in 2049. And I'm glad I watched it because honestly, this podcast was an excuse for me to watch this because frankly, I would never have done it on my own. I don't have any interest really just because of the criticisms I had beforehand without seeing it. I'd find to be valid, but it's still fascinating to watch because it is. I'm glad it's available. I'm glad it's on the Blu-ray and that they took the time to clean it up and make it look pretty because it is part of that movie's history. And even if you don't prefer it, at least somebody who does prefer it has that version of it.
I know roundabout Lucas criticism accepted. I
you said it, not me, sir.
Oh, please. I yes.
your preference is the final cut?
It actually is. I think that it's tighter. I think it flows really well. I think that it's gorgeous and it's probably my preferred just for fixing the stunt person shot.
Yeah, that was awkward to watch.
through the plate glass and getting Harrison Ford's kid to say the line so that the actual ADR and Harrison Ford's mouth movements match during
that's
the
scene right.
where he's interrogating
oh
the guy.
Oh my
with the,
God,
the snake.
I totally, like, I was watching it and I was like, I can't remember if they corrected this in the final cut, but man, oh man, is this bad.
How does that get past quality control is my question.
That's another question I have. You know, a lot of people really jumped on board with the theatrical version. It was a limited audience, but there was especially the film community was really like, oh my God, this is a beautiful film, like film directors and things like that. But it's funny how many continuity errors and how many technical errors like that are in the original film. Like it is they're glaring errors. And it's funny that people are still like,
yeah,
oh yeah, I loved the movie from the get go.
Well, I mean, in a sense, it's like the original Star Wars, where there were always those flaws with it, but the sheer wizardry of the story that was put together made up for any, like, you leapt all of those gaps because, I mean, this is going to sound really out there, but one of the things that I've always defended Star Trek V, or to take it another another step even further, is the blaxploitation movies of the 70s that I've always defended about them because I enjoy them, is that, yeah, these are flawed films, but there is such an exuberance behind it. This is somebody who wants to tell you this story so bad, you can't help but get that infectious enthusiasm from it. Now, that might sound like I'm taking Blade Runner down a peg, but that sort of skill and enthusiasm and those sorts of things come together where you look at it and you say, your brain is able to look at it and say, I forgive this flaw because I enjoy what's happening.
Yeah, the overall picture is enough to make up for those flaws. And right. You don't really care. I mean, it's like one of those things where it's like, if you're watching somebody on stage perform like a band or a comedian and they forget something or they flub a line, you're right there with them. And you're like, we don't care. We love you. This is great. So it's like you're willing right. to go along with it for what it's ultimately doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Just pick up and keep moving and I'm with you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So how many origami unicorns, how many legend legend B-rolls do you give the original Blade Runner? On a scale of 1 to 5.
5. Hands down. It's a cinema classic. I don't know how you can look at it. It's amazing because it's based on a book that it hardly resembles in a lot of ways, but it is... I have the same reaction watching this as reading the book, where it changes the whole game for me and how I look at things. But I don't love it just because of that. I love it because it's also incredible. And I was captivated by it all over again.
I completely agree. It's hard not to be drawn into that movie. I don't think it's so much of a ridiculous statement to call that arguably the most visually stunning movie out there. It is on that level of, like, put any number of, like, what the best looking films are on a list, and Blade Runner should be on that short list. Like, it should be near the top. It's just the stuff they pulled off is amazing. It really is.
Yeah, completely agree. Completely agree.
Yeah, I agree with 5. And then, so Blade Runner 2049, let's just jump right into it. So I just saw this. I really wanted to see it in IMAX, but I just saw, like, a regular 2D screening. Did you see anything fancy? I know Roger Deakins specifically frowned upon 3D and warned people.
God bless
that man. Kind of like, I know, thank God for Roger Deakins. But I know he specifically said, yeah, I don't see that. But what did you see it in? What format?
I saw it 2D, and I wound up, because of where I live, I saw it at a nice ritzy theater where I would describe it as the 9 IMAX Limax screen, where it was in the huge auditorium. So we were rows back, but the screen was huge. So the viewing experience was was absolutely wonderful. No, it was digitally projected, but they didn't leave any filters on or anything. It looked, this was the premium theater that they put it. This was their number one type of theater where they put the big, big Star Wars type releases in.
Nice. So, yeah. Yeah. I'm very happy that I have a couple really great theaters here that don't go the cheap route and make you pay. I mean, they do make you pay for, like, RPX, the super sound and video, but their normal theaters are actually really good. And I was pleasantly surprised by the screening, because I was nervous. I was like, oh, maybe I should have seen it in IMAX, but the sound and the picture was amazing. So I saw it in just regular 2D. Honestly, I would love to go to my true IMAX theater and check it out there. I don't know if that's spoiling my review, but, like,
It wasn't shot in real IMAX, though, was it?
I don't think it was.
Then they would just do what they did. I remember I went to an IMAX, a real IMAX theater, to go see Inception, and all it was just a really beautiful 70mm print projected extra large.
Yeah, I saw Skyfall the same way, where it was just they blew it up. Nothing was shot in 70mm or, like, anything to fit that screen's format, but it just looked great. And I feel like Blade Runner 2049 is a movie that should be seen on that kind of screen.
Yeah, I can say hands down, you know, do you want me to give my review out of the gate, or do you want
to
go ahead?
Let's do spoiler free reviews right now.
My spoiler free review is that I was shell shocked at the end of it. I went in, I knew the running time. And so I like, it's very easy for a movie with the running time of this. I was waiting for it to hit that one where it's like, oh, it's 2 yawns old now, that sort of thing. I was so in love with this after I watched it that for the first time in a very long time, the night I went to sleep and I had
dreamed of electric sheep.
Yes. No, I dreamed that I was in a scene from the movie. Like, I wasn't reenacting a scene from the film, but, like, my dream was in one of those surroundings. Like, that's how I know it. Like, it went way into that deep fatty tissue of the brain where the lizard brain exists and got in there. I thought it was great. Blew me away.
I had a very interesting reaction to this, and I wrote a review on the Nerd Party blog that you can check out. And in that review, I said it reminded me a lot of the very first time I saw Blade Runner. The first time I saw Blade Runner, I didn't like it. But minus that outright dislike, my reaction was very similar. I was kind of like, what am I watching? What am I supposed to be connecting with? Oh my God, this looks amazing. What's happening? I don't know how I feel. Oh, I really like. Oh, wait, but what? So I was very baffled, but I knew. I walked out, like, Sarah, my wife, and I, we walked out of the movie, and I looked at her and I said, that was one of the most fascinating films I've ever seen. Like, and I cannot believe it got released as is by a major studio as a major release. That was that I was like, I cannot. What a brave move on Warner Brothers' part, because it is so unconventional. I knew I liked it, but it was just kind of like, I was like, I don't even know what to think, but my God, am I glad that movie got made and it didn't get compromised by any kind of meddling. It's clearly not compromised by studio meddling, but I, it stayed with me. It's stayed with me. You know, I keep talking about it with people and kind of being like, you know, I don't know, but you know, this stuff is really great. And, you know, I did love the, and you know, oh my God, and you've got to see it. I quickly go from like being very like, you know, trepidatious about it to being like in love with it. And it reminds me kind of of when I saw Blade Runner, when I was like, I didn't like it. But then I thought about it more and I was reading about it more. And then I watched it again and again and appreciated it more. And I can say for sure I liked it. I don't know if I would ever, it would ever be on the level of Blade Runner for me. Like, I don't know if I'd call it one of my favorite films. But I can't say that for sure. I think it is absolutely without question a worthy sequel. It, no doubt. Like, it absolutely fits.
I would have to say, I would have to add on to that, that my reaction to this is very similar to the way I reacted to Dunkirk. The first time I was watching Dunkirk, I had about halfway through this disconnected moment where I suddenly realized that I'm so unaccustomed to an actual filmmaker making art that I'm having trouble connecting to it the way that I used to. Huh. And I actually talked about this with a friend of the network. I hope he doesn't mind that I'm mentioning his name, Nick Anastasio, where he and I, you know, exchanged some messages where there's this part of our brain that responds to art, and it is, with the current slate of large blockbusters and studio story groups and stuff like that, it's starting to atrophy. We had the good fortune of coming up during this fabulous phase of filmmaking that kicked the norm aside and was filmmakers going for broke and making art even when it was a big budget picture. And that's what I think this is, the same sort of thing. This is an actual filmmaker who comes at it from, like Nolan, from the perspective of an artist, saying, this is what I'm doing, this is what I want to do, this is what I'm going to get to, and you're going to let me make it. And, you know, to your point, the studio saying, you've got a big enough name, we'll let you get away with it. And, you know,
and part, in, well, you know, part of it, I think, is just Warner Brothers. Blade Runner has such a history and has such a history of like, oh, the studio came in and ruined this beautiful art film. I think that was part of it, is that was always probably in the back of their mind. Blade Runner is a black sheep for us that we kind of screwed over, and we became the big bad studio in that scenario. So we're just going to trust the artists. We're just going to, like, just believe that they know what they're doing. And I mean, like you said, Denis, I only know how to pronounce his first name now. I'm sure I pronounced it incorrectly in the first half of this episode, so I'm just going to call him Denis. Denis and I are on a first name basis. But he, amazing filmmaker. I mean, a rival Sicario, Prisoners. I know we talked about this, but he is an incredible filmmaker, up and coming. I think he's arrived, no pun intended, for the director of Arrival. But it is such a bold decision by Warner Brothers to say, okay, you turned in a two and a half, like nearly 3 hour long movie, and this is what you want, and that's your vision, and we're gonna go with it. And damn whatever reactions we get, this is what it is. This is clearly. The vision is so strong that I really have to give Warner Brothers credit. I don't say that lightly, because my first reaction coming out of the theater was like, oh God, how are people going to react to this? There's no way, like, general audiences who don't know what to expect are going to be positive about this movie. That they're going to react the same way the first Blade Runner audiences reacted to that one.
I can tell you that my prediction, What I think this film is sentenced to, is the Tron Legacy reaction, which is I came out of Tron Legacy saying, it's a masterpiece. Oh my gosh, you've got to see this movie. It's great. I love this. And people going and seeing it or not seeing it or eventually seeing it saying, yeah, okay. And it's heartbreaking because I think that Villeneuve. I'm going to say Villeneuve.
You just call him Denis. I mean, we can all be besties.
DV and me. I think that this finds itself in that territory of, in a sense, explaining. As much as I've been praising the art and Warner, you know, we're sitting here talking about Warner Brothers took a chance and let him do this thing. I want this thing to win tons of awards because this, based on the box office reaction, becomes the very argument against not writing on there and having a story group mandating that you have to have, you know, AT-STs and Grand Moff Tarkin in all of your films. You know, you get what I'm saying, right?
I get exactly what you're saying, and I completely agree. And that was something I like. It makes me love the movie more. This movie was not made by a committee. It is clearly an expression of people who loved the original film and had something they wanted to add to the table. Let's go ahead and delve in. I want to start touching on some stuff spoiler wise. So just a heads up for people who haven't seen it, we're going to go into spoilers. If you want to come back later, feel free to. I encourage you, and John, I'm sure you would say the same, go see this movie in theaters, support it. You know, give it a chance. If you're not a fan of the original Blade Runner, maybe be careful. But I think film fans should be supporting movies like this.
Even if you don't like it, it's so incredibly important that you support it.
Exactly.
I know how stupid that sounds to some people because, movie tickets are $15. But the prices are going to keep going up no matter what. And please, let's give ourselves a shot at a movie like this being made every so often. No, please,
I agree.
Don't take this away from me.
So I'm just putting up a spoiler flag now. I wanted to discuss a little bit what I think is better about this movie than the original Blade Runner. And I think mainly Blade Runner, the original film, even though I think I would say I like it more, and I do like it more, story and character-wise, I think Blade Runner 2049 is unquestionably stronger. Blade Runner is a great ideas movie. Lots of interesting, intriguing ideas about the nature of, like, what does it mean to be human? Are we human? How do I know I have a soul or whatever? Blade Runner 2049, even though I think its big disadvantage is that it's using the original as a springboard, basically. It doesn't do anything visually striking in a new way because it's using Blade Runner as a template for its visuals. And thematically, it doesn't necessarily do anything particularly original that the original Blade Runner hadn't already done. But it goes in very interesting directions, and a lot of that has to do with Ryan Gosling's character, Kay, who you find out within like the first few minutes is a replicant. And it's like, oh, he's a replicant. All right, he's a Blade Runner that's a replicant. Okay. And his arc throughout the movie, the more I think about it, the more affected I am emotionally by it. And I was watching it and very like, oh, this is cool. I like this. And a little concerned about like, wait, is he just going to be Harrison Ford's son? I don't know how I feel about that. But then it turns out he's not. And that twist is so devastating because you realize he even though he was so terrified and horrified by the notion that he might be different, he had started to take stock in that, like, oh my gosh, maybe I am special, maybe I am different. And then he finds out he's not, and despite that, he still decides, like, you know, the circumstances of where I came from don't matter, I can still choose to do something meaningful with my existence.
I think you're spot on with that. And the scene where the giant hologram of the hologram that he was in love with, like where he realizes he's just been manipulated by the consumers. What's interesting is watching Final Cut and then this is there's even more of an undercurrent of, and I make reference to this book all the time because it is one of my favorite sci-fi books of all time, The Space Merchants.
I've never heard of it.
Frederick Pohl and C.M. Kornbluth. I highly recommend it, but there is very much an Philip K. Dick's original novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, it's odd because the Blade Runner aspects of this, showing the city and everything, are very much space merchants. But then, like, when he goes out to the nuclear wasteland, that is much more from Dick's original novel. That's right. What the world looks like.
Yeah.
And I found it fascinating to watch this because I think that a truly tremendous artist in both the director and the cinematographer went back and said, we're going to make Blade Runner 2, but we're going to bring in more of the source material to make it even more familiar to people who have always, like me, played that dumb trump card of, well, you know, it's not exactly like the original book. And they they forced it down into my eyes. And I was like, yes, give
well,
me
you
more.
Know what's funny is Hampton Fancher, I think is the guy's name. He's the co-writer on this movie. And he co-wrote the original Blade Runner. I think that's great. And he actually, the opening scene where Ryan Gosling's character goes and sees Dave Bautista and they get in that huge fight, that is very inspired by the original opening scene of Blade Runner where, like, Deckard goes and shows up at a guy's house and shoots him in cold blood, and then you realize, oh, it's a robot. Oh, my God. So it's cool to see those things sneak into this movie. Like you're saying, the Philip K. Dick references, the references to the scrapped versions of Blade Runner, and then, like, ideas that if you're familiar with this film's troubled history, a lot of stuff was sneaking in that was really, really cool Easter eggs for fans without necessarily taking away anything from somebody who knows nothing about it.
Yeah, and I have to say that one of the best and I think boldest choices that they made with this film is the fact that they didn't fix the world by the end of it. This is a personal victory film, and the person I saw it with said agreed with me, but we sat there talking about it where we said this is so weird because this is a movie where you know that if the studio had been involved, they fix the world, and he kills Jared Leto's character and everything's okay. And the sun is shining on New Earth for the first time, you know, that sort of thing. But this stays very true to the idea that this is...
it's a world on the way out.
Like this is the tipping point moment. And
yeah.
Something
is changing, and this is the moment where... I get what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, but it's amazing as well because there's so much commentary on the very nostalgia that brings a movie like this to the forefront, because when they have that showdown and there's Marilyn Monroe and there's Elvis playing in the background and then there's Sinatra.
Oh, that scene was so good.
It's such a sly commentary on the refusal to let go of the past that brings a movie like this up where 30 years later... or 40 years later, or however many years later, they say, oh no, we're going to make a sequel now. Really? Yeah. You waited this long for it? But then you see this thing, this whole thing with Harrison Ford, where he's living in this place that's evocative of a past that informed the original. Like it works on, as I think about this film more and more, it works on even so many more levels, up to and including... very much carries forward the Tyrell as devilish, like in the first one, Tyrell is presented as this, you know, I'm seeking God and you are my God and I'm doing this. Whereas Leto in this is very much the devil. And so there's this interesting counterpoint with that where he's functioning as an anti-Tyrell while being Tyrell in the plot. Like, and it's so amazing. And the simple fact, and I know I'm rambling on now, but the simple fact that they have a name like Jared Leto playing that role.
I've got to say.
And they use him so sparingly.
Yeah. Well, I wanted more of him. I thought, I never thought I'd ever say that. Give me more Jared Leto. But he was fascinating. What an incredible performance. Terrifying and hypnotizing, just like the movie. But, I mean, if I were to knock this movie on anything, there were a couple areas where it was like by building the world, they almost made it a little bit too tempting to go in that direction. Like the whole idea of the replicant revolution and all these different ideas that I was like, oh, wait, where are you going with this? And then it never necessarily fulfills that. Jared Leto's character, I almost wanted more of him. And I don't know, now that I think about the movie as a whole and the way you're describing it right now, it's hard to think of like, well, what else would he do? I don't know. But I guess maybe because there wasn't so much of a resolution with his character that I missed. And then I think the Android Revolution was the thing that threw me off a lot. I was like, where is this going? This came out of nowhere.
Oh, but
and then it's never really brought up again. And I was confused by that. And they were like, oh, you have to, didn't they tell him he had to kill Deckard? I was just confused at what the motivation was.
No. They told him he had to kill Deckard because they didn't want Deckard to get, they didn't want him to get tortured to give the location of where they were, the information about them. But the thing that I loved about it was that, like you said, this is a world on the way out, and the whole thing is that they hid the special child in plain sight, and she was the one putting the memories in the replicants that made them foment the revolution. So she's working for the big evil corporation while implanting the very memories that are going to encourage them to rebel against the status quo. Like, there's this... And that's the thing that I love about it, is the same thing that works so well about the first one, is none of it is stated for you. It's there, but it requires that extra effort on your part. And that's, those are the films that I adore. I love that, where I can sit there and somebody can ask that question. I haven't even thought about it for a second. I go, well, no. This is what it is. This is what, like, you know, like, these are the discussions that films should be making us have.
I agree completely. And I gotta say, I mean, you know, we're talking about this now, and it's after the opening weekend, so we know now that the film underperformed, and it's technically a disappointment, at least domestically. There's a chance, I mean, the international box office could pick up, but we're talking about a $150 million movie that made about $30 million in its opening weekend, and you have to think, like, okay, with marketing costs, double the budget, so this movie has to make maybe $300 to $400 million to break even, is what people are saying. And I have to ask, like, I mean, what do you think it is? And people, I want to kind of turn this into other people's reactions. We've talked a lot about what we thought of the film. How have you talked to many, like, just general audience, like audience members who went out and saw this movie? Because I know immediately, like I said, I thought, like, I was like, there's no way anyone who walks into this cold will like this movie. There, like, you know, there's no way, unless you're like very open-minded or a film fan, you have to really brace yourself, because the movie doesn't play nice with you. It says, get on our level. We're not giving you any answers. You have to follow, you know, you have to play with us. You're not going to sit there and be passive while we throw all these beautiful images at you. We're going to make you like pay to play, basically, and pay attention to what's going on. Do you think that is what turned people off? I just want to know, have you talked to anybody who saw the movie who didn't have any kind of reference point for this?
I haven't, but what I can tell you is that I have yet to talk to somebody who has seen it who hasn't seen the original. The person I went with had not a tremendously positive impression of the original. He was like, it was okay. But he had a more positive reaction to this one.
Wow.
And I can also say that definitely what hurts it, and that this has been talked about many times in terms of, you know, big releases and everything, 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's a big ask.
Yeah.
People are going to stay away from it. And you can't play as many screenings. You need something to be like Titanic, where it plays for, you know, 6 months to make the kind of money that they need to make all of their money back. And instead, you have a situation where the landscape is different, and a 2-hour, 40-minute movie, I can already tell you, as much as I love and adore her, my wife, known on the airwaves as Agent Bun, I can praise this movie until I'm blue in the face, but I will still look at her and say, I'm pretty sure you're not going to like it.
I can say that to a lot of people. And I honestly, people who didn't like the original, I've been like, be careful. This is, I've been telling people, I don't know if this is necessarily a standalone film. From what I can gather, a lot of people who don't know the original have seen this and liked it. So that, I mean, that may be completely off base, But just because of the stuff that they brought back with Sean Young's character, Rachel, a lot of the parallels to the first movie, little like seeds from the first movie, I was like, ah, you're going to be enriched if you've seen the original. This is going to be more enriching, more enriched experience. But I knew what I love about this movie and what I know is going to be so frustrating for people, and what has been so frustrating for people who don't know what to expect, is that this is such a perfect sequel. It's almost too perfect, because in this landscape, people are not going to sit for nearly 3 hours for a movie that is a very slow, methodical, thoughtful, visually stunning, but not a whole lot of action, not a whole lot of like things happening. It is such a huge risk in this day and age, because we have things like Star Wars, we have things like Marvel, where the big expectation for revival movies is, come on, bring the action, bring the fan service, bring the excitement. And I kind of expected this new Blade Runner to take precedent from that and kind of be a little bit more engaging, and was pleasantly surprised that it was just like Blade Runner, and that it wasn't trying to really play, it wasn't trying to reach you on your level. It was trying to bring you up to understand on its level. And I appreciate it. As I was watching this, I was like, God, I don't know what anyone else in this audience thinks, but I love that this movie is trying to challenge us right now and that it exists at all. I don't know. Man, the box office is not surprising, but what a huge disappointment that is. I mean, do you think it's the nature of the beast? Like, is Blade Runner just not supposed to reach a mainstream audience? Like, what do you think? What is it? Why aren't people reacting to this? You know, is it just the fact that it's just not exciting? Is it a big sci-fi movie that's more ideas than like lasers and action?
Yeah. I do. I think it's as simple as that. I think that, you know, to get back to everything we've been saying this whole time, is that this is not something that is designed to be anything but what it is. It's not trying to capture wallets. Like, this was somebody who just came in and said, this is the story that's going to be told, and this, you're going to like it or you're not, and this is what it is. And this is the terms films should be made on. And on top of that, while I hear, you know, budgetary things where they're like, oh, they spent $150 million and then marketing on top of it. I mean, these people.
That's a terrible impression of me, John.
No, it's spot on, actually. I think that everybody will agree that I sounded exactly like you. But the entire thing is $150 million. That's what they spent on, you know, they spent $100 million on Terminator 2. 30 years ago. Well, then by my estimation, they got this for a steal, because based on the way it looks, holy crap, it deserves every award on the face of the planet for cinematography.
Seriously.
And editing.
Oh, I know.
Like, and that's the thing that I hope for, is if Warner Brothers, I think maybe that's what they're hedging their bets with. If Warners can win a ton of awards or nominations with it and become a prestige sort of house again, then that becomes the thing that they can throw out there. That will assuage the bean counters and those sorts of things. And just to tie it into something else you said, where it's like, oh, do you need to like or see the original to get... Would you tell somebody that they need to see Star Wars to enjoy Empire Strikes Back?
No, I guess not. I mean, Empire... The difference I would say there... Because I saw Return of the Jedi first. That was my first Star Wars movie. I was a kid, so I was less like, I didn't need to understand what was happening to enjoy it. But Star Wars, all three of them are designed as entertainments.
I think you mean eight, Sean. There are eight Star Wars films. Soon to be nine.
We'll talk about that in another episode. But no,
there are six, young man.
The original trilogy, each one stands alone as entertainment. You can watch it and enjoy it and feel like a satisfying story. Blade Runner has it got its reputation by being outside of that norm. And same thing with Alien. When that came out, everyone was like, oh, another sci-fi movie, great. And then they were like, oh my God, I'm going to throw up. And I think... That's the difference. I want to encourage people to watch the original Blade Runner, first of all, because you should watch it if you haven't. But also, I think it preps you. It's like, brace yourself. I know you see the flying cars, the holograms, the crazy visuals, Ryan Gosling, Harrison Ford, explosions in the trailers, but brace yourself. This is not that kind of movie. And the only thing I can think to compare it to is Blade Runner. Watch Blade Runner and get, if you watch that and you can get yourself in that mindset, you will appreciate Blade Runner 2049 more. It is fascinating to me when people who haven't seen the original like this movie. It's also baffling to me when people who love the original say they hate this movie because it's boring. I'm like, are we talking about the same movie? Because it's very similar as far as pacing goes.
Although the final cut of Blade Runner was like an hour and 54. That's to ask 50 more minutes to ask a certain number of minutes more is, at this pacing, is a lot. But at the same time, it's not indulgent. It's not taking a long time for any reason except to sit you there with the characters to drink in what's happening. And I think it's something where we have just dulled our senses, where if this were something thrown out in the multiplex day, pre-multiplex days, where it was you got five or six movies playing at your theater, this would still find its niche audience the way the original Blade Runner did. But now you got 13, 14 movies. And then when a Star Wars movie comes out, you have 10 screens showing Star Wars and 4 movies showing something else.
Right. And we're getting to the point where it's like 2 Star Wars movies a year, 5 Marvel movies a year. There's no space for a movie like this anymore.
Right. And so the thing is, you sit there and everybody loves to, oh, that's McDonald's. Oh, that's fast food. Yeah, but when you eat that, when you eat a steady diet of fast food, I could sit down, I could sit steak tartare in front of you, and you'd look at it, you'd be like, yeah, it's okay. Like, like that's just what it is, man. And for me as well, for many years, I've championed Ryan Gosling as an actor, but wow, what an incredible performance this is. What an incredible layered performance this is. And I think that that is another thing about this film that just takes it to another level, is every performance is great. And I don't know the actress's name. Please forgive me for not knowing the actress's name.
This is who plays Joy?
Yes.
Anna de Armas.
No, but there's Joy, but then there's the actress who plays...
Love?
Yes, Love.
Yeah.
What a performance.
Yeah.
What an incredible performance that is. And that's another thing, is the performances take it from Blade Runner is asking, what's the nature of reality, but what's the nature of humanity, and can machines ever achieve humanity? This film takes for granted the idea that machines will eventually become human. Will we ever get to the point where we won't treat them like servants?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's it. It's this dark mirror that is fascinating to watch,
Like the original, I could just tell. I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to watch this again, because there's so many ideas to unpack thematically. But visually, I mean, Blade Runner is a very visual movie. You could argue that's its strongest asset, but you forget about these things, the plot and the characters and what it's trying to convey. I think Blade Runner 2049 is more successful in some ways at conveying some of these themes than the original. But it's a really beautiful story. I loved the relationship between Kay and Joy, his AI girlfriend. I thought it was so beautiful without becoming ham-fisted or cliche or dull. It was one of the more engaging plot lines in the movie for me. I love that this movie, there's so much to unpack. And I just want to see it on an IMAX screen, because my God, Roger Deakins, who is maybe, probably, definitely the best working cinematographer in this day and age, who for the life of me, I don't understand why doesn't have an Oscar, I guess it doesn't matter at the end of the day. We don't need him to have an award, but my God, if this doesn't get him something, that long overdue award that he so rightfully deserves, I can't. I'm just going to light myself on fire, which I know would please a lot of people, but okay. I would prefer not to.
Okay, everybody, no awards for deacons. Right now, it's a Christmas present for me.
But I should have said it.
Yeah, I can tell you that Roger Deakins is, as a film fan, as a film nerd, whatever, you know, what have you, it can get kind of like, oh, everybody's talking about Roger Deakins. But there were shots in this that were so gorgeous that I wanted to cry.
Because oh, my God, I know. Me too.
I looked at it, and it's not even the shots that you would expect. The shot of him standing there in this gray wasteland with the gray tree, with the gray this and the gray that, and the only spot of color is his face, but it's so amazing. Like, I wanted to weep because every single shot was art, and it was gorgeous, and it was amazing. And, you know, you couple that with the performances, for me, I don't understand how people couldn't love this film. It legitimately baffles me. This is one of those films where I walk out of it and I have the reaction of I look around and I see people not liking it. And I say to myself, how, what's dead inside you that you don't respond to this film? And, oh, did I just go there? You bet I did. Because... yeah. Holy cow, man. Like, this is everything I go to the Cineplex for. This is what I want from that movie screen. This is what I want a filmmaker to do to me, to challenge me, to make everything beautiful.
I know what I want a filmmaker to do to me. Denis, well, you can call me anytime. We are on first name basis.
I didn't say I wanted this one in Feel Around. That's, I want to put that out there, so...
No, I completely agree. But while I understand... the audience's resistance to a movie like this, it further reinforces how stupid everybody is. No, how much smarter I am than all of you. No, I kind of love that. I love that people are going to come out of this movie kind of the same way people came out of the new Twin Peaks, where they were like, I hated it. And I'm kind of like, well, who cares? Because it's still amazing. It is such a strong vision and so singular and affirmed and confident that all you can do is say, you know what? You really missed it. It's not one of those things where I could be like, well, to each his own. I understand why you didn't like, I'm kind of like, I get why you didn't like it, but you missed it. And you are not doing yourself any favors by ignoring what this film has to offer. But at the same time, oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I'll go a step further. And just like the new season of Twin Peaks, if somebody says I hated it or, you know, this was terrible or anything, what I want to do is I want to go up and give them a hug and tell them it's going to be okay. I don't know who hurt you, but you can put it back together. I believe in you.
But let me ask you this last question. I saw this in a Cracked article today, and it brought up a really interesting point. Is Blade Runner flopping at the box office a good thing in this era of franchise filmmaking where everything has to be a cinematic universe? If Blade Runner had made 100 million opening weekend, how many more unnecessary sequels and spinoffs do you think we would have gotten from it? Is the fact that it might barely break even actually working in the favor of a film that is so beautiful and so artistic? And I know a lot of people were saying when they announced this, they're like, oh God, don't ruin Blade Runner, but now it's like we have this and thank God we do. But is that actually a double-edged sword that's swinging opposite direction of the movie, where we don't want this to make the money that it's going to? I mean, that sounds terrible. I want this movie to make money because I want movies like this to get the support that they deserve, and I don't want studios to look at this and say, well, I guess we don't want to do that anymore. But at the same time, I see the merit and being like, oh, thank God, we're not going to get like 5 Blade Runner movies a year. You know what I mean? What do you think about, like, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that it's a very novel argument to say, at least we're not going to get Blade Runner Covenant. But at the same time, I applaud that article for stretching so far for the positive in that. that it, you know, it basically this preserves it in amber how special this is. But let me posit this, and I will credit my co-host on a couple of shows with this insight. Making a huge amount of money and having a huge bust open weekend might give us that connected universe down the road, might give us crap sequels. But at the same time, those sequels don't take anything away from what this is. There are going to be bad sequels. And if my reward for a bad, you know, for enduring six bad sequels is that every so often I get this, cool. Let it make a ton of money. But I applaud them for looking for the positive in, you know, the house burning. Hey, the positive of the house burning down is we can rebuild and maybe repaint it too. Who knows? You know, like, eh.
I think it's such an interesting argument to pose. I just want this movie to make some money, frankly. Like, I want studios to get the message that this is something that you can and should be rewarded for doing. Don't think it's going to happen, which is extremely sad to me. But I hope this movie has legs throughout the month of October.
Yes.
We don't have any huge releases, I don't think, coming out. But, like, I don't know. I hope word of mouth
well,
gets around.
Well, we do have to contend with Geostorm coming out.
Geostorm is coming out. Oh, man. There are some movies that we should watch for missing frames. Yeah. But, all right. So, final ratings. What's our rating system for 2049?
Either baselines or joys. How many baselines? Do you meet your baseline or let's say joys. How many joys do you give it?
How many joys do I give it? I wish somebody would give me all the joys because my goodness, talk about my new crush, like Ana de Armas. What a great performance, but also I'm in love with you, so call me. I'm just kidding, Sarah.
Paging Mrs. Eastridge.
I would give this on a scale of 1 to 5 joys. I'm going to give it a strong 4 for now, but I expect that to grow. I walked out of this movie knowing full well that I wanted to see it again, that I enjoyed it. There were things I had issues with the plot. I do think the running length does kind of work against the movie. Like you were saying, you can only sustain that for so long, but there's so much to love about the film, the visuals, the performances. The fact that there's a good Blade Runner sequel at all is a miracle, and that I feel like deserves credit. Like that's an amazing accomplishment no matter what. But what about you, John?
5 out of 5, hands down.
Okay.
I think that this is a modern classic. I think that 2017 is an amazing year because it gave me Dunkirk and it gave me this.
Yeah.
And I will forever remember 2017 as the year where something went a cut above, and there were two filmmakers who didn't settle, who said, "I'm going to make what I want to make."
And do you think this movie is better than the original Blade Runner? Which do you prefer?
I don't think that... I never think that's a fair question. I really don't. This is a totally different sort of thing. All I can say is that it's having the same effect on me that the first one did, which is I can't stop thinking about it.
I can say that as well. I think the first one will always unquestionably be like, yes, that's one of my favorites. This is more than worthy of the mantle of Blade Runner, which is just incredible. Because I remember when they announced the movie and it was like, are you kidding? No. But here it is, and it works, and it's beyond what I expected. It's because it played things so close to the original film. By being so unconventional, it ended up being a very conventional Blade Runner movie. But I do hope people go out and see this. I would highly recommend it. Hopefully you didn't listen to the whole episode if you haven't seen it already. You just skipped to the end and listened to this part where we implore everyone to go see this movie. It really deserves your attention. But anyway, John, thank you so much. It was a pleasure getting to talk about Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. And again, follow us on Twitter. I'm at @YeShondorman. You can also follow The Nerd Party at @JoinNerdParty and like us on Facebook at The Nerd Party. And John, where can people find you?
Look for me at Kessel Junkie. I'm on two other shows on this network. I'm on a show on the Trek FM network and I'm on a show that's out there. But follow Kessel Junkie. I pimp myself out pretty hard. So that's where you can find other stuff that I'm on too.
That's great. So we'll go ahead and, you know what, we'll just get on with our lives. It's too bad we won't live. But then again, who does?